Spencer Fogle was used to hearing blood-curdling screams on his way home from school. Like most Filmington kids, he normally ignored it and kept walking. It would be some film crew nearby making a horror movie or a crime show or an ad for hair defrizzer. But one Monday afternoon, Spencer turned a corner, heard blood-curdling screams and stopped. He couldn't pinpoint why, but these screams were different. This was no actor's performance. These screams were real. So starts The Flytrap Snaps, book one of the Flypapers series written by Featherston author Johanna Knox. The Flytrap Snaps introduces us to a young Spencer Fogle, resident of Filmington, which is sort of a centre of excellence for the film industry. Spencer finds himself at the heart of a mystery involving an unpleasant film mogul and loan shark by the name of Jimmy Jangle, his hapless henchwomen Cassandra and Sybil, a missing scientist, and a Venus flytrap with rather a lot to say for himself. I popped along to visit Johanna at her home one balmy summer's evening. Sitting in her study amid the hopefully non-genetically altered Venus flytraps, I began by asking Johanna just when she first began to write.
Hey man, what's the matter? What you doing standing up there shaking like that? Ah, well the boys are gonna tell you what to do. Listen to them.
And more than anything else, I wrote stories when I was a child, and I wrote really long stories, and I think I had a sort of, at a young age, I had a strong awareness of the importance of editing, which is kind of interesting, because a lot of kids, you know, they don't want to edit, they just want to write, and, you know, understandably, but for some reason I was, maybe it was a sort of a perfectionist thing, I don't know, but I can just remember being, you know, at the age of 10, being that kind of stereotypical stressed out writer, kind of late at night trying to finish homework assignments, writing things, and, you know, because there was no computers to just, you know, cut and paste or delete or whatever.
Yeah.
You know, I'd write something and there'd be too many mistakes on the page and I'd scrunch it up and throw it in the bin, and I had the overflowing waste paper basket. And just sort of, I mean, in my head, I remember it as being to all hours in the morning, but it probably wasn't. It was probably 8 o'clock or something.
It feels quite late when it's small.
Yeah.
You kind of exercise that muscle clearly, you know, as you were growing older. But with the Flytrap Snap, this is your first published novel for children.
Yeah. I had a sort of a published educational textbook kind of thing before that. But it was the first trade book,
And you mentioned earlier on that your parents were keen environmentalists, and there seems to be a kind of a maybe an environmental or a social subtext going on in the Flytrap Snaps, which I was really intrigued about. The way that you've transformed Flemington into Filmington, and you know, that kind of commentary going on about you know, the transition of a place from one thing to something quite other. Do you feel that that's something that children are becoming more aware of? I think, you know, as grown-ups we can be a little bit kind of down on what kids kind of perceive and are acting upon. But
I think, I mean, all of us, we're all kind of aware to a greater or lesser degree of this kind of tension between country and city and between rural and urban.
Yeah.
And you know, however it manifests, and you know, people who live in towns don't realise in lots of ways how their whole life and economy is dependent on rural areas. But to some extent, I think maybe rural people can be a bit dismissive of people who live in urban areas. Not everyone, you know, that's a terrible generalisation, but there's a little tendency that way.
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, it's just good to bring that out in a children's novel, and I'm not trying to sort of answer this or moralise about it. I just almost wanted that tension to be there as a background.
Yeah.
So that, you know, it could be something that kids could discuss if they want, but I'm not trying to, I don't know if I've done this or not, but I'm definitely not trying to push a certain point of view.
But also in this novel, you know, change has also occurred on quite on the molecular level as well, with the genetic the genetic engineering. Was that also a bit of a commentary on the kind of challenges we face today? Or?
Yeah, to some extent. Yeah, again, I'm interested in that idea that these things can be created in horrific ways through, you know, or ways that we, or some of us would think are wrong through genetic engineering or whatever. But once they're there, they're a living being, and, you know, you have to kind of be, feel some compassion towards them. And is it right to say that they shouldn't exist now, now that they do? And just all those kinds of questions that I think genetic engineering and any sort of new biotechnologies like that bring about.
And in a way, you're giving the genetically modified Venus flytrap such an awesome character. I mean, he's kind of...
Yeah, I like him.
He really... you know, he doesn't like girls. He doesn't like anything to do with kind of reproduction.
Yeah.
And he's got a wicked sense of humour. And you know, he questions that whole, well, you're just going to get rid of me now, you know. That, and I think that's a really nice moment as well, that, you know, cool. Spencer's kind of brought up short by his talking Venus.
Yeah.
Have you managed to speak to children directly about their engagement with the book?
A little bit, yeah. I guess it's often in, you know, apart from kids I know well, it's often in quite hurried situations, you know, like you're at, I don't know, Storylines or something, and kids just want to get the book signed, and then mother goes, oh, yes, he loved it, or, you know, and that's it. So it's like, you know, and I'm pretty sure that sometimes it's like, oh, he loved it, and kids sort of standing there grumpily, and I think, okay, actually, I don't think... this book probably was right for this kid, but, you know.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, not. I don't expect all kids to enjoy it, yeah.
And the sequel, where does that go, take us to? Because we're kind of left in a bit of a cliffhanger situation that I seem to recall.
So there's book one, yep. And then there's book two. The cliffhanger at the end of book two... is resolved in book three, which we're just working on at the moment.
Okay.
There's 8 books in all.
And, oh, wow.
And so each one is going to probably have a little bit of a cliffhanger ending, but there'll be a sort of a narrative fulfilled within each one at the same time. And then by the 8th novel, the whole story will be resolved. And
how wonderful.
All the loose ends will be tied up, I'm sure.
And do you have that framework in your mind now? I mean, the 8-book framework?
Or, I was sort of, I was actually forced to really go further into detail into it than I had before. Because briefly, it was very exciting, but it was very brief. We had a British film company interested in it. An animation company, which was exciting.
Yeah.
But, they really wanted to know where the whole series was going. And I had a clear I had a general idea in my head. I sort of knew how it would end, and I knew a few milestones along the way, but not in as much detail as they wanted. So I had to sort of sit down and plot out the synopsis of the whole series in a lot more detail. So that was a really good thing to be forced to do, and despite the fact that it came to nothing in the end, it was almost worth it just to be forced to get the whole 8 books worked out plot-wise.
Yeah.
And it's, I feel good. I feel on much more solid ground now that I sort of know exactly what's going to happen. I can't box myself into any corners.
No.
Plot-wise.
And how long had the idea for this 8-book series been germinating?
When was it? It must have been about 9 years ago, perhaps.
Right.
Because it was when my son first got interested in carnivorous plants, which was when he was around about 6. Yeah, and I first started to think about what would it be like if these plants came to life.
Had you had any interest in carnivorous plants before then, or?
I think I was a little bit. We did have a Venus flytrap when I was a kid, and I think I was a bit interested in them. But I got more. I was an annoying parent, and I sort of took over my son's interest when he got interested in them. But
I think that's one of the great things about having kids, isn't it? Is that you can explore interests and avenues that you hadn't had a chance to when you were a child, perhaps. And
definitely.
So the flytrap snaps kind of introduce us to Spencer Fogel and his family. And then the sundew stalks, because that has been published, hasn't it?
Yep.
And that was earlier on this year.
Yep.
Could you give me a kind of potted a synopsis of that particular?
Well, what the sundew stalks does, which is book two, is it tells, you see, in book one, Spencer, there's this mysterious girl, Tora Durand, in the background, who he has a little bit of interaction with. In book two, it tells, it covers the same time period, but it tells it from Tora's point of view. So you see what she's been thinking and what she's been doing, and then you understand all the little snippets, all the little views you got of her in book one, and you also see Spencer through her eyes. And so it kind of gives you a fuller picture of the whole story. It fills in a lot of gaps. And then I think it's the last two chapters, maybe three, it pushes the story further and it goes ahead with Spencer and Tora together.
Right.
It's a new bit of story that you haven't, it's a new part of time that you haven't had it all in book one.
Got it.
If you see
okay.
what I mean.
Yeah.
But then from now on, it's going to be just, it's going to just sort of move forward. It's not going to be covering similar ground.
How does it feel when you're, because you sounds like you're having to write to a timetable. I mean, people are expecting manuscripts on their desks.
Well,
potentially.
Yeah. Certain people, yeah. Yeah.
How does it feel when you're in it? And is there a sense of, what's the word? Anticlimax when it's finished? What does that feel like for you?
Oh, when I'm in the middle of writing something, all I want to do is do the best job on it possible. Mm. And when I reach the end of the time that I'm allowed to spend on it for whatever reason, actually there's always a feeling of sort of frustration and right. dissatisfaction that if I just had a bit more time, I could have done a slightly better job. Or, I think that's normal. I think everybody feels like that in all sorts of endeavours.
Yeah.
But, you know, usually you come back to it again a year later or so and look at it and go, oh, actually, it's all right.
Yeah. And how do you fit it in? Because clearly you're busy, you've got a family and, and work. And how do you fit the writing in?
I have to sort of just carve out space to work on it, really. Yeah. I have to just say, okay, I'm going to have this extended period, because it's very hard to do it in a bitty way.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's like, okay, everybody else in the house is going to go out for 4 hours or 5 hours, and so then I've got the house to myself and I can really concentrate. I don't know, it would be good to be able to cultivate the art of writing in a cafe or something. I've always thought that would be good, you know. I never quite managed to do that.
So you need quite, you know, that quiet space and know that you're going to be undisturbed.
Definitely.
My temptation is always to go and do the washing up.
Yeah,
well, that's true too.
No, you definitely have to be quite firm with yourself.
Is Spencer Fogel, he's such a lovely boy. He's clearly got, you know, great head for business. He's got two parents that don't listen and seem to live in quite a chaotic, life. But is Spencer based on, is he like a composite boy, or does he have any traits of people close to you?
He is completely himself, and, you know, in my head, he has a life of his own.
Yeah.
But I guess this is a trait that my son and I both have of sometimes being indecisive, because we just keep thinking, oh, this, but on the other hand, that, and, you know, weighing up everything and really wanting time to weigh things up. Yeah. That's often perceived as a sort of a negative trait, and I just wanted to write something that was sympathetic to somebody who had that trait, I think, just because it's in the family. But
I'm always interested in that, not being a writer of fiction myself, you know, hearing when writers talk about the characters in their head. And you say, you know, he has a life of his own.
Mm.
Can you be in a situation and you think, well, I think Spencer would react like this, or you'd know he'd react like
Oh, yeah, I think so. And actually, an interesting thing was when we were doing book one, as I was writing it, we were also working with the illustrator, Sabrina Malcolm. And it's funny how, like, you know, she drew several different versions of him, and we would talk with Walter, my partner, who's, you know, partners in the publishing business. Yeah. We would talk about, you know, which one to use and what characteristics he could have. But Sabrina would always come up with new, interesting features that he could have visually and physically. And once, I think it was, she just sort of presented this version of him one day, and we just went, oh yeah, that's perfect, love it, you know, which was nothing like I had imagined him in my head, but it just seemed perfect as soon as we saw it. And funnily enough, once I had that vision of him in my head, things about his personality sort of solidified as well, and it became easier to imagine his reactions and what he'd do in certain situations.
Yeah. Did you have to spend time choosing an illustrator, or was Sabrina a natural choice for you?
Sabrina was a natural choice. So Walter and I, we work on, like, we have this publishing business, Hinterlands, which puts out the flight papers, and we do other bits and pieces. And he's a graphic designer and art director, so he really sort of took the lead in thinking about how to go about the illustration and get an illustrator and, you know, all that kind of thing. Yeah. But, yeah, I mean, we were both very much in agreement that Sabrina was a perfect choice because we'd worked with her before, and her son was a good friend of our son, and, you know, also we knew she had that background in botanical art.
That would be quite important, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
Given that kind of the botanical nature of the storyline. You've got, you know, another six books to write, or you're in the process.
Yeah.
Sounds like a lot, doesn't it, when you say it like that? But what comes after that for you?
Well, I've got, I've always got just way too many ideas, more ideas than I'll ever be able to execute. So it's just sort of a matter of choosing which one. I've got one standalone novel that's been on the back burner for a really long time, that I'd like to do something with, probably before the Fly Papers is finished.
A children's novel?
Yeah, a children's novel, yeah. And I've got a series that I'm working on with another illustrator, Adele Jackson, which is being serialised in Forest and Birds magazine for children, Wild Things. Yeah, so we're just going to keep working on that children's series. That'll be coming out in episode 5 times a year in each magazine.
Right.
And maybe it might lead to something else that would be nice, you know, a sort of a bigger production.
Yep.
Of the characters and that sort of story. And I've just had another idea recently for another children's book I'd like to write too, but I can't reveal anything about that because I'll jinx it.
Do you think your groove is firmly set in children's fiction, or might you dabble in something for an older market?
It's pretty firmly set there at the moment, but also in the back of my head I have a sort of a, it would either be adult or it would be sort of crossovery young adult.
Right.
Which I'm really too scared to think about too much, because I feel like it's the kind of thing that it would just consume me if I started trying to work on it. It's just not something, it would require a lot of research and, a whole new set of world building, and I've already got enough of that on my plate already, so, yeah.
You've got a few realities you can retreat to if you want to at the minute.
Yeah.
What were the children's authors that you were inspired by and continue to be inspired by?
Well, I suppose these days, like in sort of contemporary times. One of my all-time favourite authors is Lemony Snicket.
Oh, yes.
I mean, I read all those books to my son, the whole series of unfortunate events when he was younger, and it was just the best. I still sort of think back to that time when we read those books with nostalgia.
I read those as a grown-up. I think I was at university, and what struck me, it was then I think it occurred to me what makes good children's writing, and I think you exemplify this as well, is not being afraid of tackling some of the difficult subjects. And certainly that the Lemony Snicket, you know, opens on a very bleak moment in those kids' lives. Would you concur with that? It's important not to patronise.
Definitely. And not... I think you don't want to... No, that's not true. It's not that I don't think you want to moralise, because I think writers can't help their own sort of ethics and value systems coming through in their writing. I think that's always going to happen, no matter what. But I think you want to sort of open up discussions with any writing, for children or adults, rather than sort of seem to be trying to push through a narrow point of view on something. The other thing that I wanted to do in the fly papers also was look at economics a bit.
Right.
So, you know, Jimmy Jangle, the main villain, is, you know, he's a shark, basically.
Yeah.
He loans people money that they can't pay back, and he knows they can't pay it back, and he charges exorbitant interest and imposes conditions they can't meet. And so I was, at the time when I first was sort of developing Jimmy as a villain, I was thinking a lot about the economic system and, you know, the problems with debt and interest and, you know, how
And Spencer is quite careful with his money, isn't he? And he understands the value of money.
He does.
I like the, you know, the way he's got that $25. He says to his mum he hasn't got the $25 because he knows that they'll just fritter it. The way he kind of explores all his potential options, and what was lovely is he actually made $25 sound like a lot of money, you know. seemed to come up with so much he could do with it.
That's true, yeah.
My daughter's only 4.5 at the minute, and the other one's 2.
Right.
But I reckon in a couple of years we'll be romping through these books.
Cool. And then there'll be more by then.
Absolutely. And I'm not going to wait for Isla to grow up. I'm just going to read them myself anyway.
Listen to me.